Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik. Greg Lindsay cannot join today because he is in the air. And we're very happy to have as our guest, Hanif Kara. Hanif Kara is a Ugandan-born practicing civil and structural engineer and professor in practice with Harvard University's Graduate School of Design. He's the co-founder of the design engineering practice AKT2, which today employs 350-plus people, projects across 50-plus countries. And for the past 25 years, he has pioneered the company's interdisciplinary ethos. His approach, research, and publications have together driven AK2's unique positioning. The practice has been recognized with 400-plus design awards, including 4 Reba Sterling Prize wins. And we're here today because he is the 2022 recipient of the Fosler Kahn Lifetime Achievement Award from the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. Welcome, Hanif.
Thank you, Daniel. Nice to be with you.
Yes, and it's wonderful to have you. So we, for the uninitiated, I should probably give a little bit of background on Fosler Kahn before we go into discussion of the award. He was a pioneering structural engineer who worked for Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill and a number of other firms in Chicago, and is best known for his tube-in-tube structural design and exoskeleton frame, which was deployed on the now 875 North Michigan Avenue Tower, formerly known as John Hancock Center, and the tube-in-tube technology, which was deployed on the former Sears Tower, now called Willis Tower. And his engineering innovations were picked up and adapted and advanced by many practitioners in the field ever since, including Hanif Kara. So I wanted to ask, what does it mean to you to be the recipient of the Fosler Kahn Award?
Well, it's nothing short of moving and kind of a little surprise and something that one would never have dreamed of from many angles. The surprise, I guess, is that you never imagined this. I first read about him when I was in a graduate school, and you never imagined you could be connected to such a big name. And the second part of the surprise, I guess, is that I've always assumed you have to be 50,000 or 5,000 engineers before you even get close to this kind of award. And the third surprise is it's a lifetime. I think I'm only halfway through my life, so hoping that there's more to come.
We're always a little cautious when we call it a Lifetime Achievement Award because, yes, we don't want to presage that someone is nearly done, which we certainly aren't here. We're maybe the better way to look at it is you've already made a lifetime's worth of achievements, and we're looking forward to your second life.
Fantastic. Sounds good to me. So it was all of those things. All of those things and happiness and overwhelming emotion, which is rare in structural engineers. But, you know, I have another connection to him, which is obvious. I'm an immigrant myself and, you know, follow kind of the way in which he imagined his life. Isn't hugely indifferent, although we're in completely different times and technologies in a different place. And the population has increased by a couple of billion since he was around. But all that said, he's still a hero, so it's fantastic.
That's wonderful. Yes, I should mention he was a Bangladeshi immigrant to the United States.
That's right, yeah.
So in my companion interview with the Lynn Beadle Lifetime Achievement Award and background, Lynn Beadle was the founder of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. The recipient this year was Peter Wynn Rees. He spoke very highly of your work in making London's modern skyline a reality. So when you think back on it, what were some of the more challenging projects that you've brought to life or perhaps that you're still working on?
You know, this question is at many levels. It's first of all, it's connected to your first question to some extent. You know, how does one feel when one gets to do a tall building in the first place? And then in the second instance, when you're in a global city that influences the whole world, how do you, the second component of trying to get to a tall building in a city like this where the competition is so high. So you know, in it's very generous and kind of Peter to say these things. And I guess for me, it would mean that I'd have to go back to what is the type of engineer that I was thinking about, even, you know, before we got to the tall building stage, which was about 10 or 12 years ago when we did our first one. So, you know, being young, it's quite difficult to pin it to what were the challenges. But I can say that my striving towards a Sophrosyne and urbane character in terms of the direction and striving for that direction for engineers was probably the main agenda which led then onto these sorts of projects. You know, it's quite interesting and important to say that, because I found myself surrounded in the last 15 years, and so did the practice, by a kind of a characteristics that are hubristic in the world of engineering when it comes to bridges or tall buildings. You know, there are certain people that just assume it's their right and no one else should touch one. So the challenge was more about saying, well, actually, you know, with the striving that I've done towards a more urbane approach to structural engineering, surely I could, you know, we and I in my practice could do tall buildings. And Peter was in the scene at the time. So I think I was very fortunate that there were people listening and saying, well, what if people like, you know, Hanif and others were given a shot at these supposed buildings that you've got to be super experts at to be able to do, because they do take a slightly different approach in design, not just about how tall it should be and how tall one can make it. So, you know, in general terms, the beginnings were earlier than that for me, because in my early life, I spent a lot of time offshore on oil rigs, and I always wondered how and why that particular typology can build so much below water, and when we come out to buildings, we struggle because of the kind of overlaying of disciplines and professionalism, whereas more pioneering work was done in offshore oil rigs. So I was interested as a structural engineer in the technology, but like Fazlur, you know, I was also a broader thinker. I always thought, well, anybody can make it stand up. It's really whether we've got the material or somebody to pay for it. So when London started really booming, maybe I would say 10, 12 years ago, we were halfway through it. One of our first towers would have been a rather small tower in American standards, you know, 240 Blackfriars Road. But it hits the nub, because London was beginning to kind of trace its cluster, certainly the center of London, whilst at the same time, you know, we have the polarity at Canary Wharf, which is like a mini New York, because it's a series of extrusions, post-Mesian rectangular boxes. Both of those things were beginning to enter the scene. So I was fortunate enough immediately at 240 Blackfriars to be confronted by these seven corridors, which kind of dictate the shape. And when you look at 240, it can get any more, let's say, novel. And when you understand it, you can see it's pure. What are the places we can put any object in and avoid these towers? Not long after that, and the other complexity in London in general has been what's below the ground, because we have 4,000 years of history of what we have done as engineers underneath. You know, we have brick tunnels and arches that are next to us, or deep sewers, and also the ground. So the challenges are usually below ground. And the second challenge, I guess, is in not just accepting the corridors, but how can you make it a little bit more exciting? We were fortunate long after that, not long after we won that and started to develop a kind of off-center core and think of a way how you build something like that. And we used a banana core in that one, where as we were lifting, as we were building it, the core had to straighten itself up, the concrete core, as the weight was being put on, because it's eccentric on plan form. So it had to kind of straighten up when we pour the last floor. So it moved something like 150 millimeters through that process, which our client was in a nightmare situation worrying about, but we as engineers were able to predict, and the constructors were able to do that. As a consequence of that, the same contractors actually invited us to what is now the Castilla, which is Richard Rogers as the original designer, where we were extruding. It's an elephant and castle. But the drama was that, you know, extrusions and residential, so a change from an office tower, a small office tower, to residential, immediately changes the nature of complexity in a tall building. You know, it can move less because people in residential, you've got to be careful. But you also need to add something more interesting to it. And, you know, the Richard Rogers approach was to hang from the top on what is a 50-story tower, all the balconies. So we have a crown on top, which gives it an identity. So the peculiarity in London specifically, because of the corridors and because of the funny shapes, let's say, that come out, they're idiosyncratic, people start to put that into the system. So it gives it something, an identity. And in the case of Castilla, the crown on top of it was the kind of, let's say, the interesting bit that would give it an identity. It would be the one, the tower with the crown sort of thing. Although it's not been given names like the Gherkin or the Shard or any of those, but we were always conscious it needed to differentiate itself. And I think the complexity largely came from that. We looked at that in CLT, which we can come back to. We built it in concrete. It's a square cut across the corner, so it's a square plan now with 8 sides, and the corners are then filled with balconies, and the balconies are hanging from a crown right at the top. So from the city view, you see the crown first, always, and as you approach it, you see all these balconies that are hanging. So the kind of, you know, in response to your question, there are a range of difficulties, but a range of, let's call it, challenges that take us a little bit outside pure structural engineering, which goes back to what you said in the introduction, in that I was broadly more interested in taking bigger design decisions that are citywide, less concerned about the quantitative ways in which we measure buildings. You know, the quantitative assessments have to be what they are, net area, how many units, and so on. So, you know, that would be two. And in neither case did we plan, you know, to be monumental or even plan to win awards, but they have. They've both become quite iconic because of the locations they're in. And now there's a whole spring of towers. The second one there, Castilla, was outside the viewing corridors, so we could go fairly tall. And it all became about how quickly to construct it and you know, which way can you sell residential. You know, I can't leave it at that, unfortunately. As I said to you, London is, in when it comes to towers, is a city of two. You know, in that there is the historic viewing corridor zone, and then there's the Canary Wharf, which, as you will know, and many of your audience will know, is largely a tall tower zone built in the last 40-odd years in the dock in East London that has more towers, you know, per square foot than anywhere else in Europe. So there's 40 or 50 years of history on building on building tall buildings that are largely office space, big bank buildings, extruded. So it's the kind of scene, you know, the mundane sort of endeavor of indifference is apparent in all of them, which is what tends to happen when you work efficiently and you have to build fast and you have to fill in space to put people to work. That was a second kind of problem, because the freedom was controlled now by what was already built. And fortunately for me, I would say probably if I were to single out the most challenging project, I would say it's One Park Drive, because we had the challenge of Canary Wharf Construction Company, who know what they're doing. They built a lot. They know more than anyone else, in my experience. So why would they want an engineer who can articulate himself slightly differently? AKT2 was seen as kind of architects, engineer, why would you have that? Well, it was interesting because they wanted to reinvent a particular district. And to cut a long story short, Wood Wharf was going to shift the area into residential mode because all the office buildings were finished, and now suddenly wanted to invade it with a district that is residential. So there was a master plan which we were involved in, and then through that master plan, Herzog de Meuron won the first tower, which we are engineers of, One Park Drive. And for me, that's been probably the most, I wouldn't say challenging, but the most satisfying tall building. Because on the one hand, you know, it deals with the city. On the other hand, it deals with the human scale because it's residential. And then thirdly, it has to compete with all of these beautiful, you know, what we would call 90s towers, but they're all excellently built. So the client had, you know, challenges in terms of can he afford to do something more interesting and complex. And the minute you do a rotunda, immediately there's a concern, you know, why have we not done one before? Of course, you shouldn't do one again. You know, you shouldn't do one for the first time. But fortunately for us, the formal and interesting mix of that particular tower that has four typologies within the rotunda. So what it does is it has, from the top down, interestingly, the design that we all discussed right from the beginning is it would have different typologies. It's like a London street, but in a vertical sense. You'd have penthouses at the top, bays coming down, then sky amenities, clusters, and loft. So these four typologies gave it a difference. It gave it the whole kind of rotunda as a unique challenge. And the structural response to that was, for me, very interesting because on the one hand, we had the tools by then, the technological tools, to not start by saying, we'll use outriggers or use core to stabilize it. We had to keep it open for quite a long time because as the architecture and the ideas developed, you know, binding the macro and the micro of humans and what units we would use, because most of the units are very small. As we did that, what we found ourselves doing computationally was really sharing the core and the outrigger up and down. So instead of the 80%, 20% rule, to share the two, we didn't make those decisions, you know, almost until we could actually get the tenants and start constructing. And vertically, the typology with the four differences in use allowed us to change the system. So part of the tower is wholly stabilized by core, and the other part, lower down, it takes benefit from an outrigger. So this additional complexity that I feel is a component of design, and it's something that you couldn't have done. It's a qualitative as well as a quantitative assessment because it costs more because every room is different or each district within the tower is different. But it was deliberate because it couldn't afford to be ordinary. It couldn't afford not to compete with what else has happened in the world and so on. So I'd say that's one that I enjoy the most, and it's only just finishing. So some of the interiors are beautiful, and clearly the envelope ratio is significantly more than what people are used to when it comes to towers, because we step the balconies quite a lot, and the rotunda is not acontextual. Nor is it icy like some rotundas with a glass skin, because it's got this granularity on the surface. So you can approach it and want to go in it and not be afraid of going into it. All of those interesting things impact structure and impact how do you keep it fast built, quick, but also high quality response, changing of floor to ceiling. I'd say that's been the most interesting, whether it's technically challenging from an engineer's language. I'm not sure that, though, that's important, because I think one of the dilemmas with the with towers is that, is you know, how do we actually justify doing any today, particularly in cities like London? And I have a lot more, Daniel. You know, I could go on and on about 19 Elms or where at South Bank or Finsbury Tower, my colleagues have added on top of existing towers. But shall I pause at that point?
That was extraordinary. Thank you for that. I obviously there is an entire universe to unpack just within working as a structural engineer of tall buildings for A-list architects in London, let alone the rest of the world. Most of the terminology you used was familiar to me. I've been in this business for 10 plus years, except did you say banana core?
Yeah, what I meant was it's shaped like a banana. So we had to build it like a banana because it's on the left-hand side of a plan. Most of the building hangs off it. So it's shaped like a banana as we drew it. And then as you build it, as you add weight to it, it straightens up. So that straightening up of a core was very frightening to our client when we told them it's all concrete as well. So effectively, when you do an eccentric core and the vertical load increases on it, you tend to pull it, whereas we built it out as we went up the building and started adding weight to it, it straightened up. And we didn't know whether we'd get it right until we did the last floor. This is something quite unusual for an eccentric form. Yeah, that's what I was referring. We call it a banana core because of its shape. If you first draw it and then you put all the weight on it and you see it will end up being straight when we finish with it. I hope it makes sense now.
Indeed it does. I'm just thinking if that were obvious on the outside of the building, clearly it would be one of the named towers in London. Now you'd have the gherkin, you'd have the banana.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Only techie engineers like me and constructors would be excited by that we straightened it out by nearly 200 millimeters without cracking the concrete or the floors. That's a techie thing, I think. You don't see it.
Well, it is nevertheless a great achievement. I would like to also now move into CLT, as you mentioned, cross-laminated timber. You know, a very different material, functionally, conceptually, and you've done quite a bit of thinking about it. You collaborated with Jennifer Bonner at Harvard GSD on a course and then a book called Blank, Speculations on CLT. You know, this is something that we're really starting to see in the last couple of years, you know, particularly in tall buildings, mass timber is suddenly taking off. What inspired you to undertake that project and where do you see mass timber going next, or for that matter, any other non-conventional materials other than concrete and steel?
You know, it's not that new. It was the first inspiration. And yet in the US, it was being talked about as though it's completely new and will solve all our problems. So the inspiration came from saying, hang on, you know, first of all, it's not new. Secondly, as I said to you, like tall buildings, when a new material arrives, there are lots of hubristic approaches to it. So in this instance, you know, some experts in timber architecture would say, only I can do it. Or experts in timber engineering would say, no, this is me and my favorite contractor who can make the CLT can do it. So the inspiration was really to bring it to mainstream and put some reality check on it in both design terms and also the reality of constructing. So what's interesting is we had already looked at this material in detail when we did Castilia. So Castilia is a tall building and next to it is a 10-floor social housing scheme, part of the same development, which is actually one of the first CLT buildings in the UK. And therefore, when I was at Harvard and a lot of discussions were happening, Jennifer, who is a very close friend and we've talked together before, wanted to build something in CLT. She'd worked in the US, she'd worked in the UK, she'd worked in Turkey and Europe. So she knew that design was taken slightly with a different interpretation when you come in from Europe, particularly Scandinavian countries, and was familiar with this new material in theory, was coming out of Austria, Germany, and so on. So when she decided to do her first project in Atlanta with her practice rather than the school, we both were confronted by a shutdown of everyone. So first shutdown was, will it ever sell? Because it's perceived to be so new and unusual in Atlanta. Second object, let's say second risk, new risk was, who would build such a small house with such an expensive material? And then the third one was, what are the aesthetics when you're designing something like that? How do you treat something that is surface, architecture, structure, feeling, you know, well-being, quality, all these other things attached to the same piece of material? And the last material that did that was concrete, as we all know. So all these questions were raised, and we felt so hurt by having to build that little project of hers and all the obstacles. In the end, we actually even got a European contractor to assemble it for us, just to prove, to make it and then get it assembled in Atlanta, just to prove that it was doable. And it's been a super success. House Gables, it's called. It's been on many magazines. So that inspired the studio, because what we then wanted to do is say, okay, let's have a bigger discussion in the studio and draw out of that some what I would call design research. So we got a little bit of sponsorship from Tirrens, a Swedish trust called Sven Tirrens, and we deliberately went to Sweden to look at where, you know, there's a lot of manufacture of CLT, and we set the problem of doing a house and a tower, you know, on you know, kind of pulling on the bridge and the tower idea of the historic book from Yale University. I forget the author, but we wanted to use a house and a tower. So we did that studio, and I have to say, all the conversations were fantastic, because the tectonic conversations at Harvard, but also the emerging issues around climate that we're all dealing with now at GSD and everywhere else, were coming together through thinking about a single material. So these were the motivations, and the way we tried to play it out was, one was House Gables, Jennifer's project, and the second parallel activity was run at least one studio and seminar and go visit Sweden and the manufacturer and try and explain to everyone, actually, you can all design this if you think of it slightly differently. And that's where the book's title comes from. You know, if you think of it as a blank surface that it arrives on site, why does it not need an architect? Which is one of the questions we raised, because we were being told it doesn't need an architect. You know, the manufacturer makes it, we bring it, and it's assembled.
And so that was a material that, you know, you kind of referred to as a blank, which is a really interesting way of thinking about it, because everyone is so obsessed with the texture, right, of timber, and the biophilia of timber is such a major feature of it. Can we go back to the spot where you were talking about Sarah Kulturhaus in Sweden? Because that's one of my favorite tall timber projects.
I use that as a reference, because when we visited it with the students, it was under construction. And what I wanted to show them was, you'll have to lift your heads out of being stuck in the thickness of thin architecture, which is what's been happening with glass and steel and concrete. That one of the things about doing stuff in timber, it's big and it's thick. You know, some of the columns in that building are 1.5 meters square, which I knew. And you have to combine CLT with glulam techniques and so on. So it was ideal. It was an ideal position to show them what happens when you build tall. They'd already fully aware with houses, because Jennifer has a magnificent one that she can show. So Skellefte is since finished. It's a remarkable building, you know, with long spans in some places, multi-use. In both cases, one of the big discussion, and it's not for today, is how we look at sequestration, because that's been around. The argument is that it's very, very green, but it's not as simple as that. It's a very incongruous binary statement to make, because it depends on, you know, the farming and whether you're sequestering backwards or forwards. And there are lots of discussions on how you measure life cycle assessments using CLT. Nonetheless, it is a super material, and we're using it on the Google headquarters in London, where we're using 30,000 square meters of it as a floor plate. So it's how you use it, but how do you design with it, that I think has a lot of discussion, a long way to go.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a misplaced aspiration to talk about how tall can we go with mass timber, because it's all, one could argue, and this sounds funny for me to be saying, but I think you probably would agree, is that the aspiration to go tall for its own sake is a misplaced aspiration anyway. So the idea that, you know, we have to do this, we have to push mass timber to its absolute structural limits is not really understanding the value of the material.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I agree completely with that dilemma of icon versus type. You know, how tall is tall? Do we really have to do really tall all the time? Not necessarily, you know, and type, yes, type above a certain height, it is a tall building. But with CLT, the discussion should be all about how can we dismantle, how can it have a second life, how can it be used in multi ways rather than singular use, which are all the agendas that are coming out of the climate crisis. And I think I'm not certain whether the US market is ready for it, because you build differently, and you know the customer in the US is less interested in some of the things that the European people are interested in, you know, in, even aesthetically. Some people in the US would call it a sauna when you live in a CLT house, because they don't like the look and feel. So there's a lot, Daniel, a lot. And I'm hoping to do a talk on it at with Jane Kelly, who was a copy editor in Chicago, when I'm there at some point.
Well, I will be sure to attend that then, because this is very pertinent to our own research. We have two timber research projects going on simultaneously. One is about mass timber generally, and the other one is about the steel timber hybrid construction. And one of the things that you mentioned about life cycle is going to be very important in the second one, because the assumption in the life cycle calculations, despite all the credit given to timber for sequestration of carbon, is that it's going to be disposed of at the end of the building's life, because we've never done anything else with it. And so you have the strange condition of material producers, like of steel particularly, saying, well, if you put steel in it, now the building can be recycled and we can prove it because steel has been recycled. That's a strange kind of position to be in.
Yeah, no, I look forward to talking with you about it, because urban mining is really taking off, you know, the reuse of steel, not just recycling it, but reusing secondhand steel. That's my current studio in with Fashid Moussavi in Arles in France, where we're reusing steel, and we will probably use CLT. So we've done buildings already that do the hybrid, as you're describing it, and add to that secondhand steel, not just recycled steel. So, you know, giving it an extended life without killing the embodied carbon discussion. It's a really big conversation. I look forward to talking to you about it.
Indeed. Well, you mentioned a couple of courses that you're working on in France and the US. I'm curious, you know, you're probably aware that there has been some controversies in the architectural education atmosphere. And this is a little bit less of a problem, I think, in the structural engineering field. But these two things are sort of related. You know, the idea of the genius at the center of the firm and everything's top down, you know, is a big problem in architecture. And it's something that really came to a head a couple of months ago with this discussion that happened at SciArc, where, you know, the instructors were saying, well, you just have to toughen up and be ready for this environment and work a side gig and all this kind of stuff. And the students were absolutely appalled and actually had some of the teachers removed from their administrative positions via protest. I'm, you know, that made, in my view, that was going a little bit far in reaction to it, but clearly this conversation needed to be had. And one of the reasons I'm asking you about it is because I know that it's one of the philosophies of your firm that good ideas can come from anyone. And so with a firm of that size, you know, how do you facilitate those discussions so that they can happen? And, you know, how does that correspond with the types of insights and attitudes that you try to engender in your students?
I think it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. And it's been the battleground for 100 years, you know, ever since we separated, or Corbusier and others, into two different cultures. Both have their downside. The science side, which is structural engineers, largely became over-specialized and were not interested in anything but optimization. And then the architects became far too theoretical. And some even enjoyed not building and only writing about construction. So I think that the middle ground really is design, and the middle ground is interdisciplinary discourse. So this has been the kind of main part of my work at GSD, but it's largely come out of how the practice has grown. The practice has grown through this idea of, as you say, the ideas can come from anyone in the office, but equally, we like working with architects who are willing to listen, and the majority of the people that we've worked with are fairly good structural engineers, and the majority of them will accept that we have an idea about design and architecture and will not shut us out. And that's been kind of the direction that I've taken the practice. And as I said to you, you know, being a bane in some ways, and a practice that I have recently defined as, in short, non-combustible, you know, one that won't just light up one day and then burn like a bright star. But how do you develop a design practice that has light all the time and will continue to fuel itself? And that's come from this thinking of allowing no genius in the office, and tending to even calm down some of the geniuses. As you know, I've worked with some of the best geniuses in architecture. And how do you have that conversation with them and get the best out of them, which they will only find out when they win the next Stirling Prize or something? So we foster this through being an open office, literally. You know, we have open spaces. We don't cluster into groups. We might cluster on a project. We put different ages together, different nationalities together. Nobody ends up working on one tall building. You know, if he has a tall building to work on or aspects of it, he also has somewhere to teach. He might even have a small pavilion to do. So we deliberately, wherever we can, have created an environment that has a chemistry that allows this openness. You know, we also have problems. You know, people don't always like to be open, and there are competitions, there's competitiveness in the office. But on the whole, I think we've been very fortunate, because even though we're only 25 years old, as you can see, winning something like a Lifetime Achievement Award, you know, with the Fazlul Khan Award, demonstrate yet again that if you stick to your guns, it's not going to be about past models. It's not going to be about history. It's not going to be about genius. It's just going to be about quality of work. I think that's been the biggest contributor to all the accolades that AKT have got. We have stuck to quality. We've stuck to fostering the next generation. We're still trying to do that all of the time. And we're not frightened of the competition. You know, we've worked closely with some of our competitors. It's not a big deal to us. And by that, I mean that, you know, I think you will recognize your generation probably hasn't seen it as much as I've had to see it. As we ran into the geometry world 20 odd years ago, I was seeing architects running into engineering and engineers running into architecture, because the technology suddenly made them feel they could do almost anything for no purpose or for a purpose. And we managed to opportunity out of that by saying, well, no, actually, if we become really good at what we do and have quality work, and then we get interested in making the other person look better, how do we promote that? And it's worked. You know, it's fostered. And the other thing I would say is we've been selective about our clients. You know, we don't always take every job that we are asked to do. We've been careful and strategic about targeting, say, workspace, or right now the biggest pieces of work are lab spaces in the office. You know, we do a lot of high quality laboratory spaces like the Crick Institute. And we're looking at some that you in the London scene are called TOL, but it's a lab and potential to become an office, or office potential to become a lab. So we're very adaptive. And I think that's been the response we've taken in part through watching the fight between what is the profession, what is the discipline, what is academy, and saying to ourselves, well, we can't go in that fight. We're too small, but we're also, I would like to say, intelligent enough to know that nobody's going to win that fight.
Right. And I think characterizing it as not a fight at all is probably a really healthy way to think about it.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. No, absolutely. And sadly, that's not the case at academy sometimes, as you know. Everybody has different views and the students have another view and it becomes a fight quite a lot. But, you know, what happened at SIAC and has happened at the Bartlett was necessary, important, and needs to be heard. And we need to change the models. We need to really change the models for the next generation so that they can then go on to build a better world. If they build what we've been teaching them for far too long, it's just not fair on society. And ultimately, architecture is about life. And we've got to kind of listen to this stuff.
Well, I really have appreciated hearing your philosophy on all this. And, you know, I have every confidence that you will be able to develop another lifetime's worth of achievements in the second half of the story here. You have a great philosophy, and it's been great to hear from you.
It's good. I was going to say to you, Pete, I first met Peter when he was at the city and presenting the Shard and a couple of other towers. So I was on the Commission for Architecture and Built Environment because he'd asked me that question.
Yes.
And I think he'd never, ever, ever heard an engineer because he was a city, you know, planner. Why would he? And there is the crux of our problem. We keep certain people out of certain stages of work. And when I became a CABE design review panel chair and then later a commissioner, I think I got a voice and I started to listen to what planners really have to do in order to make a city like London and have some empathy for their problem and empathy for architects who are trying to build something like the Gherkin or the Shard. And how do you make space for design in that kind of environment? So I just wanted to add that bit.
No, the interdisciplinary aspect is so, so important. And it's something that, you know, I deliberately, you know, wanted to go out and make this, well, I mean, the council is a good example of that interdisciplinary organization. And even, you know, this little podcast that I've developed is like, it's about architecture and urbanism. And the door is open very, very wide because we cannot afford for these things to be in silos anymore.
Yeah, agree. And we've got to evolve not only the tall building typology, but be able to make distinctions and listen to Mother Earth. You know, the climate challenge is not a small challenge, but we've been here before. So why can't we design our way out of it? And I think podcasts, the kind of conversations you force us into and, you know, we can open up more and more is what is likely to find the right paths through the climate crisis that we're going through. There's no single path, but if we don't do this now, I think, we all know what the outcome will be.
That's right. Well, let's hope that we can.
Yes.
Hanif Kara, thank you so much. It's Hanif Kara, founder of AKT2 and the recipient of the 2022 Fazlur Khan Lifetime Achievement Award from the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat.
Fantastic. Great. We can have a 3-hour session another time.
I very much would like to. I'll hold you to that.
Thanks, Daniel.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.